Welcome back to Supreme Myths. It is May, which means it is Originalism, Tradition, and History Month. the last episode had someone who tried to live constitutionally for a year, meaning like someone who lived like it was 1791 for a year. My guest today does not want to go back to 1791. I think that is, and I don't blame her at all. Of course, nobody would. Her name is Madiba Denny. She went to Princeton College and Columbia Law School. She worked for New York City for a while in public housing. She's worked for the Brennan Center, which is one of my favorite institutions in America right now, doing amazing work. She is writing for Balls and Strikes, which is one of my favorite publications. And probably, for those listening, you might think I'm the most critical Supreme Court person out there, but it turns out that the person who runs Balls and Strikes might be more critical than I am, just by a hair. So it's close, but we're so anyway, Madiba, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here.
Now, the reason you're here, among many other reasons, is because you've just written a book. And let me disclose to the public, I read the book. I loved the book. I was flattered to be asked to blurb the book. So there are all kinds of conflicts of interest in this podcast. But the book is called The Originalism Trap, How Extremists Stole the Constitution and How We the People Can Take It Back. We are taping this on Monday, May, whatever today is. The book is coming out when?
On Tuesday, June 4th is the official release date.
But you can pre-order it now everywhere. And I strongly strongly recommend you do so. So The Originalism Trap. Okay. First question. You are a person of many talents, many interests, and many passions, housing, among others, and other things. What got you interested in originalism? Why did you say, you know what the world needs? Another book on originalism.
Well, I think I was interested in originalism insofar as I'm interested in understanding and confronting all things that can hurt me. I'm interested in originalism the same way I'm interested in looking both ways as I cross the street and making sure I don't get hit by a car. I think that originalism has really risen to prominence over the past few decades and come to dominate judicial interpretation of what the law means, what the Constitution means, in a way that is clearly exceedingly harmful for the overwhelming majority of people in this country. And I think that especially in recent years, like seeing it come to fruition in the Dobbs decision, I think I had a sort of moment of enough is enough. And yeah, it's time for everyone to understand that, lawyers and non-lawyers alike.
Enough is enough. It's a great phrase, by the way, is exactly in this context, because frankly, that's why I wrote my first book about the Supreme Court not being court, because I was just done. Enough is enough. This on originalism, I have a question for you. So I was talking last night, telling a good friend of mine we were going to do this today. He is a PhD in science from Johns Hopkins, incredibly smart non-lawyer, just an incredibly smart, engaged, politically, non-lawyer. And this is, I said I was going to have you on, and he's read my book, and he's interested in your writing and all kinds of other things. He asked me a question that law professors don't usually ask, so that's why I'm bringing it up. He said, Eric, here's what I don't understand. It's the stupidest thing ever. Who would decide 2024 tough issues that people disagree about by what people thought in 1791 or 1868? And nobody else around the world really does this. Really? Why do smart people buy this theory? That was his question. Because he knows there are smart people. You know, there are smart people who buy this theory. But then he says, but it's not a smart theory. So what's going on? What's going on? That's his frame. What is going on? Why are smart people buying this idea that we should govern our country by ancient times?
Right. I think that's an excellent question. It's something that my fiance, also a very smart non-lawyer, asks that question all the time. Yes. I think the way he put it to me most recently was, it sounds like someone thought about it for like 5 seconds. And like within those first 5 seconds, you're like, yeah, that makes sense. But if you continue thinking about it, you're like, wait, hang on. So I want to give this the version that makes sense or makes the most sense. Like, how originalists justify this. I think they would say that it provides an objective metric because it prevents you from just sort of imparting your own biases and thoughts into what the Constitution means. They would say that.
Well, is it fair? Is it fair? They would say a more objective metric than anything else. You think they would say it's just objective? I'd like our foil, since you and I agree on everything. I would like our foil today to be the sophisticated originalist, if that's okay.
No.
And the sophisticated originalist, I think, would say, now, of course, there's going to be some uncertainty. Judging requires uncertainty, but this is the best way of dealing with uncertainty compared to other methods, I think, is what they would say.
Right. I think that's Scalia's famous quote when he said
that he
doesn't have to be. He only has to be better than the alternatives, and that's not
yes.
challenging.
Is what exactly. Exactly.
Like the idea that have you heard the joke about how if you're running from a bear, it's like you don't have to be the fastest; you just have to be faster than the next guy.
That was Scalia's line. That's what he said all the time.
Oh, was that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I only knew the interpretive theory version of that. So I think that's what they would say. I think they would say it's the best option out there, and that you can know more or less authoritatively what the Constitution means by figuring out what it meant to the people who were there and like were authorized to adopt the Constitution, to ratify it, and say like what were those people there in the founding generation, like what were they thinking? And whatever that was, that's what it means. Like that idea still governs. So that's how they would present it as the most unbiased form that we have to engage in constitutional interpretation.
So I think I think that they would say it's not a foolproof approach. It's going to be hard, but everything else is worse. Is what I think they would say. You and I don't agree with that, but that's what they would say.
The most sophisticated, at least. I think there are some that would say, "Oh, this is quite easy. I can open up my grammar textbook from 1800,
right.
just look through and see what that word means there, copy and paste that in, and now we know what it means today." Some would have more nuance than that, but the core idea is that it gives you a reasonable basis that's not as open to manipulation.
Not pure ideology.
Right.
Okay, so that's all bullshit. You and I agree on that. So why don't you give your perspective, because the audience has heard mine, on why that just isn't true. It's just not true.
It's just not true. That's correct.
Yeah.
And I think there are several reasons why, but I'll try to sort of boil these down into like the top two or three.
Yeah.
One is that they're basically pretending that there is a single objective discoverable meaning, that like we can be certain of what it meant to these people at this time. Like any actual historian would tell you it's not that simple. And there are many historians that are aggressively trying to like banging on the walls, like, please listen, that is not how history works. Like there's not just like a single uniform understanding that just governed. It's always been, the Constitution has always been subject to contestation, subject to competing viewpoints and analyses. There wasn't a single given thing. So I think that's the first point. The first point is, it sounds good as an idea that you can have a simple trick, but reality has never been that simple.
Saul Cornell said exactly that on this podcast.
I'm glad to hear him in such good company.
Yes, you are. Yes.
And I think the second major part is that even if things were that simple, that doesn't mean that we should use it. Like, even if we could identify what exactly Thomas Jefferson was thinking, that doesn't mean that he had a particularly good thought. It doesn't mean that idea should still govern us today, these centuries later, because much of the country was much worse off. And originalism deliberately does not account for the progress we've made. It doesn't account for how we may need to adapt these fundamental principles to ever-evolving needs and understandings about society and who counts as a legitimate member of that society. Like the overwhelming majority of the population was, as a matter of course, kept out of the Constitution's the rights that it bestows or recognizes. And so I think that originalists often claim that this is our best way of preventing bias from creeping into judicial decision making. But in reality, all it means is that the bias is already baked in. We just are stuck with, as they would have it, the biases of the 18th century. And as a Black woman, the 18th century are like not my ideal biases. If we're going to have biases, I'd prefer they not be those.
Yes, I get that. You just made a point. You just made a fantastic point. I have been thinking about originalism for 35 years. I haven't thought about this. If given the choice between 18th century or 1868 values, if we're talking about the 14th Amendment, if we're given a choice between the accurate recitation of those values or the modern day values of even Alito and Thomas, I think I would take the modern day values of Alito and Thomas. I mean, as bad, as terrible and as bad and as horrendous I think those values are, that I don't, I hope neither one's in favor of slavery. I hope neither one's in favor of segregation. I hope neither one is in favor of coverture. I mean, I think they're not as bad as 18th century values. So that's a great point. We're taking a worse bias and an untimely bias, and a bias we can't even really get our hands on to any degree of certainty. I take Alito's bias, even though I hate Alito's bias. It's a great point. Sorry, I interrupted you, but that's a great point. It really is.
It's choosing as a standard, says, oh, this is a workable standard, but it doesn't account for, even if that standard were to work, do we want to abide by it? Like, is it a good standard? Is it a standard that serves the interests of the public and help us actually do what I would think the Constitution, especially as revised by the Reconstruction Amendments, is supposed to do, which is facilitate an inclusive democracy. And that is not part of the originalist calculus at all.
To facilitate a inclusive democracy is not part of the originalist calculus at all, is one of the best sentences in 118 episodes of this podcast. It is a really, because it says everything. I mean, it does. I mean, it what we value, I hope, what most Americans value, and we can disagree about abortion, we can disagree about affirmative action, we can disagree about the relationship between free speech and elections, campus protests. What I would hope most Americans believe in is inclusive democracy. And they did not. They didn't believe in that in 1791 or 1868. They just didn't. That's a great point. I love that point. You tell a story in your book, which is one of the reasons it's so successful. I think all works of, creativity should have a beginning, a middle, and an end with a good story. And I don't care if you're doing science, law, or fiction. And there are, I want to, villains, maybe too strong a word, I don't know, but there are certainly people in this story who you hold accountable for this originalism, I
For
don't know,
setting the trap, as
originalism
it were.
for setting the trap. Who are those people?
Well, I think I'm a little amused. Like, if I were to identify villains in this story, I
Yes.
think I do return quite a bit to Ronald Reagan's Justice Department, because I think
Yeah.
that was where you really saw these ideas begin to formalize and crystallize from sort of like one-off thoughts into a cohesive, okay, this is what our doctrine is. This is what we are now saying, like, is the position of the federal government, and we are going to affirmatively work to change legal culture so that this is understood as the only acceptable metric of decision making. Like, not until then, like in that like 80s-ish time period, not until then did you have like an organized group of people saying the law can only be understood in this way. So I think that was a real turning point. Like, even though some of the ideas were percolating a bit before that, there have been some ideas that history and tradition could be part of decision making. But this idea, and really making it official, sort of dressing it up, giving it a JD, and that didn't really exist until like 4 or so decades ago. So I think
So,
that's a key point.
the con law professor was listening to this, understand what you're saying. But you're telling a very important story that I don't think the American public really knows, which is that Reagan gets elected mostly on the backs of Roe versus Wade, Miranda, inflation, and the Iran hostage crisis. But Roe and Miranda were clearly big parts of that election. And but his first nominee is O'Connor, because he promised a woman to be, and that's the only, in my book, I think that's the only good thing Reagan ever did, was say, I'm going to appoint a woman to the Supreme Court. I plotted that view. So, you know, but he appoints O'Connor, and the evangelicals go crazy, because it's not clear where she stands on abortion and all this sort of stuff. So something that I happen to know only because it's on my podcast, I have to mention Judge Posner once a podcast. It's just a rule. So Posner is nominated, and he and I were good friends, if you don't know. Posner was nominated in like 81 or something because Reagan wanted his antitrust expertise. They wanted to revamp antitrust. But he tells me, since he was there, friends of all those people, Scalia and Bork were promised the next two seats. And they were promised the next two seats because they're originalists. Or they say they're originalists. And they were promised those next two seats, so they started to outflank each other on the right in Court of Appeals decisions to try to get the first seat.
Like auditioning.
Yes, 100%. That's where it started, I think. I really do think that's the moment in time where there's a famous First Amendment case where they really go after each other on the lower court. And it was all about the Supreme Court, I think. So Scalia gives a speech to DOJ, as you know, in 85, I think, about originalism. And that, being an Italian-American, of which there's never been an Italian-American before on the court, and that speech, I think, is what in large part gets him to the, you know, gets him on the Supreme Court. And then, of course, Bork gets defeated because the Congress changes. But you're right. That's where it began. That's where the real originalism movement began, in Washington, with Scalia, Bork, and Meese, basically. And that's a great part of your book. As time goes on, who becomes the carrier of that torch?
Right. Well, I think a lot of the people who came up in that Justice Department, you have young John Roberts and young Alito. These people, they got their training there and go out and then go back out into the world and work their way up onto the court themselves. And I think that's another, if we're talking about the villainy and the key characters, another core component in addition to the Department of Justice itself under Ronald Reagan and Edwin Meese, is the partnership with the Federalist Society and sort of making this conveyor belt of young originalists to be able to just sort of slide them right into positions of power, whether they be in attorney general's offices around the country, or on the bench themselves. It sort of prepared them, like, okay, we have now taught these people what we say the right way of decision making is. We have our crop of young true believers, and now we can disperse them. We can set them free on the country to do as they will.
I'm pretty sure Steve Calabresi was part of that Justice Department. And he's the co-founder of the Federalist Society. So you're exactly right about all that. And then they breed, this is going to sound really demeaning. I was about to say something demeaning. Then they breed a next generation of Federalist Society, you know, and it goes on and on and feeds on itself. I want to say that this is a non sequitur, but I really want to say it because I don't think I've ever said it on this podcast. I think people need to understand that in the world of legal academia, if you're a professor who belongs to the Federalist Society and you write a book or you write a really big article or you're in the news in some way, or actually, even if you're not, you get paid $1,500 a pop for going to pretty much any FedSoc event not in your own city. If it's in your own city, it's less than that. And the American Constitutional Society, which I'm a member of and the board member here in Georgia, the younger sibling of the Federalist Society, we get nothing like that. It's not even close. And that's a big deal. It's actually a big deal because it spreads the word. These people get to travel and then get expenses plus 50. I just did a FedSoc thing in Notre Dame. I didn't know I was going to get this, but they ended up sending me $1,500, which was really nice. You know, I mean, I'm glad to take it. Your boss thinks I shouldn't be doing this. That's a different conversation. Your boss is absolutely angry at me for doing this. But if I was going to be there, somebody else was going to be there. So that, but leaving that aside. All right. So going back to the story, I have a question that I don't think your book, or mine for that matter, really directly addresses, but I think it's really important. Because earlier you made a statement. By the way, you have a great turn of phrase. I love the way you turn. You I see why you're a great writer, because you have a really good turn of phrase. This is hard to convey in sound bites, so I'm glad we're having this conversation. I'm going to state my position, and then I'll see if you agree with it. I don't know. I don't think originalism matters at all to Clarence Thomas, Antonin Scalia, Amy Coney Barrett, Gorsuch, and we certainly know Alito doesn't care. He says he does sometimes, but he doesn't. But even those four who would take an oath saying we're originalists, I don't think they are at all. I think that's their masquerade for incorporating their own ideology. We go as far as that, as I've gone. Will you say that? I don't think it matters to them at all. It will never take them off a point they care about.
Right. Yes, that I wholeheartedly agree with. I think this is a point I try to make in the book as to what I think the weaknesses about the idea of progressive originalism are, because I think originalism itself was never actually the point. I think originalism isn't, I would say it is important, but I would say it's important insofar as it's like a vehicle that helps to mobilize conservatives, that helps to implement their policy goals through the power of the judiciary. So I'd say it's useful in that way. But if you can give your Alitos, you can give your Thomases, all the hardcore originalist evidence you want. But if it supports an outcome that they don't like, they will find a reason to cast it aside. They will carve it out and bracket it off. I think that Thomas does this in an exceedingly egregious way.
I've called it insanity. Go ahead.
I've called it like the Goldilocks method of interpretation. It's like this history is too early.
Oh, that's great. I love that. That's great. Yes. That's better than my theory. Yes.
he just goes through and finds a reason that every other piece of history just doesn't count for some reason or the other. Like at a certain point, it's like he might as well say, well, that happened on a Tuesday and today's Wednesday, so we can't interpret the Constitution that way. Sorry. So I'm absolutely with you that it is a tool or a cover. It sort of provides more legitimate sounding language than just I'm doing what I want to do. It helps you brush it up and professionalize it. But at the end of the day, I think it's just a tool for conservative policy goals.
I was on a panel on Bruin a while back, and a law student asked the following question. And I thought it was a great question. The law student was very shy about it because it was a big room. But the law student said, the New York law that was struck down in Bruin, the Bruin case we're talking about, the New York law dates back to 1911, which is 111 years ago from 2022, you know, when the case was decided. And the student said, why isn't that a long enough tradition?
Right. Over a century.
Yes. 100 years, he said. It's 100 years. What do we need for traditions? There is no good answer to that. My answer was, I don't know. I have no answer. Of course that should have been. They didn't even pay lip service to the idea that could be a tradition.
Right.
So the Griswold case, or the contraception case out of Connecticut, everyone knows about, that created the right to privacy. One state out of 50. This was six states out of 50. All right, it's not 20, but still there are five other states doing what New York has done for a long time.
But those don't count.
Right.
Because of reasons.
Yes. Well, if there had been 12, maybe. Yeah, you know, who knows? Texas had the identical law in the 18, like around the time of the 14th Amendment. It was upheld. And I think Thomas says, yeah, it's one law, who cares? Or something like that. Ignoring the other 25 laws he distinguishes throughout the opinion. You know, I mean, it's... The Goldilocks is exactly what he did. It's exactly what he did. He took it everything individually, too little, too late, too much, not close enough, for 40 pages or something. I mean, not 40, but 20 pages of that. All right. One more question about Bruin. that I'm curious your perspective on.
Sure.
I have been trying to scream as loud as I can scream that the person who conservatives think are the most is the most originalist justice. That's Thomas. They always said he was Randy Barnett would he's a famous originalist for the audience. I know you know this, you know, the famous originalist at Georgetown. He always said Thomas was the real originalist, not Scalia. I mean, in fact, Randy wrote an article. He wrote an article saying Thomas is a
Was
better
that
originalist.
the faint-hearted originalist?
Yes. Well, Scalia eventually walked that back. But in between Scalia walking that back, Randy wrote. Anyway, we all agree Thomas would, by rhetoric, be the most diehard originalist by conservative standards. All right. But yet, he writes this opinion in Bruin that says history only and no balancing. And by balancing, I mean we're not going to look at the reasons for the law. We're just going to look to see if there's a historical equivalent. No one in 1791 thought that. No one. You won't find that. You won't find a soul on the planet, in America, who thought that was the way you do con law. Why isn't that?
I was saying originalism itself is not originalist, because that wasn't what they used to do.
And that's and people said that in the 80s. Like that critique is well worn. But the Bruin thing is worse than that. The Bruin thing is a method of adjudication, I think, that the court has used consistently since 1791, and really the only method the court has used. You balance the right at stake with the public policy interest at stake. Why isn't that getting any traction? Like it's not just, I mean, Saul Cornell is saying this. Jake Charles, who's fabulous at Lewis and Clark, I think it is. I'm sorry, at Pepperdine, is saying this. And famous law professors, unlike, you know, me, at other elite schools are saying this. Why is this not catching on?
I think my question would be, to whom are they saying it? Because I think something that I've tried to do with the book, and in a lot of my public writing more generally, I try to write for what I think is for normal people, for non-lawyers, like who are we communicating with? Because we can say it all the time to each other in our lefty legal circles, but we need it to break through to regular people, for the general public to be able to identify this and say, hang on, that's some nonsense, and to organize and push back against it. So I think that and you're making a great point. Like, it is extremely problematic to sort of insulate the Second Amendment in this way and make like an uber constitutional right and say only for this does nothing else count except the history that I claim matters on this day. To say that only for this do we not think about the public interest and like what policy, what the how meaningful and important the goal was for the government, like protecting people's lives. Only in the Second Amendment instance, did Thomas just sort of invent that no longer matters. We're not going to do any sort of interest balancing. I think that's a really good point, and I think that it's something that people would probably care about if they knew, like if they were told your opinion doesn't matter. The only thing that matters for constitutional interpretation, according to these guys, is what they say someone thought in 1800. I think people might get a little annoyed by that. They might say, you know, I'm looking around at the world around me. I'm looking at the gun violence epidemic. I'm thinking we should be able to do something about that. And you're telling me that all these dead kids don't matter? That's obscene. So I think there would be I think there could be energy around that if it was conveyed to people in a way they understand and could care about.
That's awesome. All of that is the most important part of the question I was asking. A less important part for me, though, is, and this is just because I'm stubborn and who I am, what it says about Clarence Thomas. And I think this is important. He is our longest serving justice at this moment in time. And there is no question he's one of our most impactful justices, which is the saddest thing ever. But what it says about him, because unlike Alito, and even unlike Gorsuch, Barrett, and Kavanaugh, all of whom I think you can find statements that suggest that originalism is extremely important, but maybe not everything.
The end all be all.
To Thomas, it's clearly, he says, it's not, of course, but he says it's clearly everything. Mm-hmm. And yet this person who says it's clearly everything writes this opinion that I called the least originalist opinion in American history. So
I don't think the words like original public meaning or understanding even appear in Bruin, actually.
Right.
despite it trying to use these sort of trappings of originalism, they never actually do what we think of as what originalism requires.
Yeah, I think it really, so what I'm going to say here could get me in a lot of trouble. You don't have to comment on this if you don't want to, or you can. It's your call. Do not feel obligated. I have tenure. Okay. You don't. So I have job security. You don't. If you go back in Justice Thomas's long career, how many major constitutional law majority opinions has he ever written? The answer is like two. Like the answer is mm-hmm. almost none. Almost none. And the one I know that he did is the time he joined the four liberals. or one of those times, I think. But in 33 years, I think he's almost never done that. So I think he's bad at it. And it showed here. No, and the reason I say that is because lower court judges are rebelling. Mm, you know, lower court judges.
Well, because I didn't realize that's where that was going.
So. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Lower court judges who hate Dobbs, liberal judges who hate Dobbs aren't rebelling against Dobbs. Lower court judges who hate everything about the major questions doctrine, which everybody should hate, mm-hmm. they're not fighting it in the lower courts so much. They're fighting Bruin in the lower courts. Like they're complaining about it. They're yelling about it. The judge in Mississippi wrote a whole opinion about how terrible this is. Other judges have done. So I do think people need to understand Thomas is not good at his job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even if we just – forgetting the value differences, because we're always going to value there. He's just not good at his job. That's my opinion. You don't have to – you can comment or not. It's up to you.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay. In your book, you talk about inclusive originalism. And that really made me it gave me a moment of I don't know what the word is. That feeling you get, like when you're watching a great movie and you get that tingly feeling, you know, like something great is happening. Because I wrote my book because of inclusive originalism. I really did. That, sure. When I give book talks on my book, I used to give big book talks, I say, I wrote this book because I was perplexed by Will Bogue and Steve Sachs and their views on inclusive originalism. So you write about this too. So what's your perspective? Describe it, define it, and tell the world why it's incredible bullshit.
So we've talked a bit about, I guess, the sort of standard original recipe originalism, the version that says the meaning of the Constitution is fixed in time. We turn to like Federalist Papers. We turn to dictionaries and grammar books and what have you. And some folks, largely like center left, said, well, hang on, this is excluding the viewpoints of a lot of people at that time, because it privileges the views and opinions of the people who were historically powerful, but it doesn't tell us about the people who were sort of pushed out of that idea of the public, the people who had to fight to be part of we the people. Their views are excluded. And so the idea of originalism for liberals says, well, we should try to take their views into account. And it says, well, we should, or there's a couple different variations of this. But another prominent version says we should talk about the Reconstruction Amendments, because that was when they actually started expanding We the People. So we can still do originalism and think about what the original public meaning and understanding was. But instead of doing the original public meaning of the late 1700s or early 1800s, we can do the original public meaning in the mid 1800s, or we can try to do the original public meaning as other people understood it, as opposed to just the names you see most often in your history textbooks. And I understand what they're trying to do. I understand that originalism is the dominant mode of constitutional interpretation currently. And so they're trying to rebrand and rework that mode in a way that works better. And sure, it might be a little, it might taste a little better than the original recipe,
Yeah.
but it still doesn't taste any good. because it still is not getting us nearly as far as we need to go. The way that people understood even the 14th Amendment, which I, you know, top tier amendment, but even the way that people understood that at the time was worse than we understand it now. It didn't include women, for example. And so I think the way that folks understood things then, even if we just sort of scooch the relevant time period, like 50, 60 years later, still isn't that helpful. And it also is still putting some version of the past on a pedestal. And it's conceding the premise that we should be basing our constitutional interpretation on what we think it meant to people then. And I just don't accept that that is the best way, or maybe even like a good way at all, of doing legal decision making. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I was, no, that's, I love that answer. David Gans, who works for the Constitutional Accountability Center, which is a liberal originalist type of place, I think David is evolving on this issue. I'm not sure yet, but he's reposted my articles very critical of originalism. So, to the extent, the issue of what liberals should do is a serious issue. And I think you handle it very well in your book. And that's so, if so, I've been asked to give a lot of talks on that issue. But you do it better than I do. I recommend if people are interested in that issue, what should liberals do with this? I think your book is really good on that. There's a second, though, aspect of inclusive originalism. What you're describing is not what triggered me. What triggered me, what you're describing, I think, is why it's tempting for liberals to use it. But I agree with you. It's taken me a while to get here. I've given some public talks where I wasn't sure. I'm with you now. You, among other people, have convinced me. No, just say no. That's my view. Just say no. But
What is that? Nancy Reagan? Just say
yeah,
no.
just say no. Just liberals, say no to originalism. Do it some other way. But the other part of inclusive originalism is the Will Bode, Steve Sachs, and other people, frankly, Calabresi and Larry Solomon, Randy Barnett too, all of whom pretty much say things like this. Well, the 14th, maybe not so much Steve, not so much Randy, but Steve for sure, Calabresi. The 14th Amendment might have been intended and meant at the time that judges would have the authority to update it over time based on current conditions. So, updating the 14th Amendment over time, this is how Will Bode defined inclusive originalism. Updating the 14th Amendment over time is consistent with originalism as long as the principle stays the same. You're just applying the principles to new facts, to which I've spent a good part of my life. And so much paper saying that's just living constitutionalism. I agree with that. I agree with that. We agree with that, right? You take a broad principle, and judges over time have to apply it to new circumstances, right?
That's just how things should work.
That's how
So
they
what
do
kind of
work.
like that's yeah that's how it works in practice. And so what I try and do with the book is recognizing that the idea of a living constitution, that's just real life. Like that's just how things work. And so our question should not be whether constitutional meaning evolves, because we know that it does. The question is, how should it evolve? Like in what way should it evolve? And like what are the things that should influence how it does? So those are things I try to get at, because think, yeah, if we're acknowledging that the meaning of the Constitution changes, that definitionally is no longer originalism, because like
Yes.
the core point of originalism, yeah, it has its different variations, with some looking at original intent versus some looking at original understanding. But all versions of originalism center on the idea that the meaning of the Constitution is unchangeable. So as soon as you're saying, well, sure, it can change, but then you're out of originalist land.
Well, what their band-aid for that, or their response to that, is we're not changing the meaning, we're applying the meaning to new circumstances, to which I always say, yeah, you're changing the meaning. I mean, what do you, it
Same
meant
thing.
X. It meant X in 1873. Now it means Y. You're changing the meaning. That's what you're doing. You are changing the meaning. You can scream about it as long as you want, but you're changing the meaning.
And that's okay. We just need to acknowledge that.
Well, I would hope. This is what my friend, my non-lawyer friend, keeps yelling. Of course you have to change the meaning. Things change, technology change, people change, values change, facts. Now they can see that facts change, the applications can change. But what they really mean by that, I think, is values change, applications can change.
Right.
And that's just living constitutionalism. There's nothing originalist about that at all. Yeah. Other than ironically, that is, I think, the original method.
So, like, just actually getting back to how people have the majority of American legal history understood how to do interpretation.
Yes. So we have about 15 minutes left. So far, and we knew this was going to happen. Anybody paying attention to me or my podcast or you or your book knows this is going to happen. We agree on almost all of the critique. On the critique, right. You and I aren't all for it. We might phrase it differently, but we agree on everything. And congratulations on a beautifully written, accessible, I think, demonstrably, obviously piercing critique of this crazy doctrine that we shouldn't be using the way we use it. It has
Thank
a place,
you so
as you
much.
Said. It has a place, as you said. But it's a small place. It's a minor place. It should be a symbolic connection to the past, which is a good thing. But no, we shouldn't be deciding our major policy questions. So here's my question.
Reading these old tea leaves.
So I think a fair response to this by a sophisticated non-lawyer or a lawyer listening to this, would the obvious question has to be, okay, you've convinced me. It's bad. What would you do? How do we avoid judges doing what maybe even some moderates think? And by the way, I'm in this boat. I'm not politically moderate, but I'm judicial review moderate. Skeptical. The Warren Court did too much. It just did. And Nixon's Law and Order campaign might not even work. It might have been President Humphrey, which changes the world if we don't have Miranda and Roe. I really believe that. I think without Miranda and Roe, there's a good chance Humphrey wins. So what's your solution? How do we avoid – because let me be clear what I'm saying here. If I thought the court could be left all the time and there'd be no downside to that since I'm on the left – I would probably choose that world. But the bottom line is when the court goes left, society goes right. That's just what happens. I mean, it's happened at every moment in American history. In those rare moments when the court goes left, which is rare, it's almost always right. But when it goes left, the political process goes right. Obergefell gave us Trump. It just did. Without Obergefell, I don't believe there's Donald Trump as president. Those 30,000 voters in those four swing states, I'm skeptical they were – I think they probably were very anti same-sex marriage, is my guess. So my question to you is, okay, now what? We agree history and tradition are relevant things to look at to gain more knowledge, but it should not be a big part of the decision. What should be?
Well, I think that the concern I think you've honed in on here is the idea of the court doing the leading, like the court getting out ahead of the public. And so something that I would hope to do with inclusive constitutionalism, as I call it, the idea of I don't know if I've actually articulated this idea yet. The idea that we should, like, our constitutional interpretation should evolve in order to make a more inclusive democracy. Like, we should be looking at the Reconstruction Amendments and interpreting the whole Constitution through the lens of those amendments' purpose and mission, rather than sort of siloing them off or viewing them as maybe like a postscript, but not as fundamentally changing the document. I think we need to see it as a fundamental transformation that should shape how that meaning changes. Like, we should be thinking about, if we were serious about these goals of having an inclusive democracy, of having a country where everyone can participate in our social, political, and economic life, then what would these other provisions mean if we meant that? So that's how I think we should be interpreting the Constitution. And I also don't think that this is a matter for lawyers alone. And I think that might help address some of the problem of the court getting too far ahead of the public. If the public is engaged on what the Constitution means. If we look at social movements as a source of constitutional meaning, and if lawyers work alongside and with these sorts of democratic advocacy groups that are like fighting for a more just society, then that could sort of bridge that gap that you identified between the courts as like a sort of top-down change, and by instead sort of turning to these on-the-ground movements. So I think, yeah, so I think I would attempt to bring them closer together so we don't have this, well, the court's going left, so now the people are going to go right. I would try to have them move in a similar direction.
So that's a fant I love that answer. And I, by the way, I don't agree with it, and I still love it. So, which is fair, right? We can do that. By the way, I want to say that Kermit Roosevelt was on this podcast, and his new book is all about exactly what you just said. We should view the the Reconstruction Amendments as our founding document. We really,
Right.
more or less, we really should. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. I love, and I love your phrase, inclusive originalism. I love it because it's descriptively desirable, and it also takes the inclusive originalism from Will Bode and Steve Sachs and puts it in good to good use, as opposed to the use as a, so now we're going to get into something hard. Okay. I mean, legitimately hard. So how do we get the Supreme Court to act in constitutionally representative and reasonable ways without it getting too far ahead of the American public? Because when the court gets too far ahead of the American public, things
There's
like presidents go
backlash.
president well or presidents go on radio like FDR did and said we have to save the country from the court, or we get Trump running against Roe and we get three anti-Roe judges. Or we get even the very 1801 Congress canceling the Supreme Court, mostly because they didn't like John Marshall and they didn't like what he was going to do. So, the court has to be wary of this. And this is where you and I think will disagree. So my view is, I think over time, American society is healthier when the court does very, very little. Because by definition, judicial review of an ancient document, even 1868 document, is going to lead to conservative results by definition, because you're looking backward. Posner always said this to me. We always look back. American legal people, he wrote a whole book on why, forgetting con law, just in general, we look back in America at the law. We need to look forward. So the solutions are in our future. The solutions aren't in our past. So my view, as I think you know, is that unless there's a clear error. I think Brown was obviously correct because I can read. No state shall deny to any person equal protection of the laws. You're black. You have to go to that school. You're white. You have to go. You get to go to that school. That school has more money, more security, better teachers, better books. You're less likely to be physically assaulted, and you have a better chance of going to college. Under state law, that is a literal violation of the equal protection of the laws. I don't care what it originally meant. Then write it differently, because that's a literal definition of the text, right? Obergefell, the same thing. I won't make the argument, but I think Obergefell is the same thing. But most other con law cases, I'm pro-choice all the way down. I would vote for a constitutional amendment enshrining the right to choose in our Constitution. I would lead that movement if I thought I had a chance. I think Roe and Casey were wrong for all the reasons that people who believe in judicial deference think. I'm radically pro-choice. I met my wife giving a talk to Planned Parenthood, but I think Roe and Casey were wrong. I think when unelected life-tenured government officials have unreviewable power, they need to be really modest and really humble and not do very much. And that, by coincidence, was the original idea. That's what Hamilton said in 78. So I would not be in favor of doing of the court doing a lot of things I think you'd be in favor of the court doing. Why am I wrong?
Well, I have a couple different points. I think one is that I'm not entirely convinced that constitutional interpretation means it's going to be inherently conservative or backwards looking. I don't actually buy that. Because I think as we're talking about some of these broad terms like liberty and like freedom, I don't need to look and see what people thought then to think about what it should mean now or what it should mean tomorrow or 100 years from now. I think that it's still just a matter of interpretation that people are free to debate and disagree about, and that doesn't actually mean it's going to be a necessarily conservative result. I think people can interpret the terms of the Constitution in all sorts of progressive ways that I would love to see. So I think that's my first moment of like hesitation with the way
Fair.
you described
And
it.
that's fair. That's fair.
And let's see. I think, and I sort of related to that, you were saying how Brown and Obergefell are clearer cut decisions, while Roe and Casey were not. I would again say, and I think this makes a point about interpretation not having to be backwards looking, that the 14th Amendment's liberty protections are right there. That we have this substantive idea of liberty, that we have these concepts of people's autonomy, and that should include bodily autonomy. So I would say that we do have the raw material there to make these kinds of
Well,
progressive and
can I hold,
forward-looking.
can I stop you on that?
Sure.
'Cause this is so interesting. And then we'll have to call a day in a minute, but I want to stop you on that. So I think the difference, I'm not sure I can make this argument, so I'm embarrassed already, but I think the difference between Roe and Brown and Obergefell are, I understand how slippery this is, but from a 2024 perspective, I don't think legally required segregation can be justified on any reasonable basis whatsoever. And I think 70% of America thinks that. Okay. Sadly, not 95% or 98%, but I think certainly the vast majority of American people think that. 70% think that. Okay. And I think on same-sex marriage, that's more complicated. But the problem with same-sex marriage is no one ever came up with an argument as to why they should be different. It hurts traditional marriage. Well, what does that mean? It doesn't mean anything. I mean, but none of that is true for abortion, because when I present my reasons why I'm radically pro-choice, just in general, and why I would vote for, I would be, my you call it the Siegel Amendment, I'd be proud, an amendment to enshrine abortion as a constitutional right. The person next to me says, "But I think it's murder. I think this is murder." Now, if someone says to me, "I think segregation is good," I'm going to say to them, "You're just wrong." I mean, there is right and wrong in this world, and that's just wrong. And if someone says to me, "No, I think two men should not be married, although two men and women can be," I think that's just wrong. It's just morally wrong. It's not morally wrong to say abortion is murder. I mean, I don't agree with it. It's not my view, but it's not morally wrong. Now, so that leads to my following question. Why do you want judges to decide that? Because I don't see
So,
the other, there are two sides of the, there are two legitimate sides of the abortion argument. I don't see two legitimate sides of the discrimination, of the segregation argument.
well, I think that the idea that abortion is murder, which I obviously disagree with,
And me too. And me too. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that it would be. I think there are multiple problems. One is that I think you are constitutionalizing one religious idea. So I think that it would be inappropriate to block abortions when that conflicts with other people's religions, like for other versions of Christianity, even. It conflicts with Judaism, conflicts with non-religious people. So I think that's your first instance. It's like, well, you might think that, and that's unfortunate. However, that is your religious belief, and that should, like, you can have your religion, you can't have other people have your religion. So I think that there's a sort of First Amendment-y type issue there. And I think there's also an equal protection issue, because other people who don't have bodies capable of pregnancy, their bodies are not being regulated in the same
So
way.
wait, I have to pause. I'm sorry. I love this answer. I have to pause though. People who might be capable of getting pregnant, or so that's something like that is what you said. I have teenage social warrior teenager girls, and to them, were you thinking? Can I just say pregnant women? I mean, to me, it was always a binary: women get pregnant, men don't. That's changed. Is that why you paused there? Is that the reason you hesitated?
That is one such reason. It's not the only
Okay.
reason. So one
Okay.
reason is because sometimes I think about it and I realize that it's actually the most accurate description, because not all women can get pregnant, whether they've had a hysterectomy or whether they just have some sort of like other
Sure.
bodily problem. Also, this is tragic, but girls get pregnant,
Yeah.
girls who have been assaulted or otherwise taken advantage of. And so I think it's a more inclusive term. And also, it accounts for trans people who could also be pregnant. So I think that when I look at the sort of broader scope and think about all of the people who can be pregnant and all of the women who might not be able to get pregnant, or whether they're menopausal or what have you, I thought, you know, actually, it's just more accurate that way to say pregnant people as opposed to necessarily pregnant women, if I could be talking about a girl or a trans person or anybody else. And when we're also, as we're talking about pregnancy, we are specifically talking about like a biological function. So that's why I wanted to say people who's like happen to have a biological function that works in this way are being treated differently than everybody else. And so I think that that's a problem as well. It's like a an equal treatment issue and an issue about being able to exercise any sort of determination and autonomy over your own life in a way that the state is not infringing for other people. So I think that even in this world, if I were to say, sure, that person, I disagree, but they might earnestly think that abortion is murder, you still run into a whole heap of other constitutional problems when it comes to liberty, when it comes to equal protection, and when it comes to religious freedom.
Maybe, but I want to, but I guess I hate, I'm going to play devil's advocate for the purpose of the podcast. Maybe, but I do think I need another constitutional issue. Don't, I think the second half of your argument, I think the only, I need another issue where another human life is at stake. 'Cause I, now again, you and I don't view it as another human life, but there are people who do. So your analogy only works if the government, if you can give me another example of where there's another human life at stake. Now I think
Organ
we have,
donation.
sorry? Yes.
Organ
Well,
donation.
no, I think right. And I the example I go to in those situations is the twin brother. This is a riff on a famous example, but the part of it's mine. The twin brother who runs over his brother, literally runs over him with a car, so he can inherit his dead parents' money. Doesn't kill his twin brother, but puts his twin brother in the hospital, and his twin brother is going to die unless he gets a non-invasive 1 hour or 30-minute bone marrow transplant. I'm making medical terms up to save his life. To save his life. Now, this guy intentionally hit him for a bad reason, the worst of all reasons. We still don't make that brother give him that. We don't make that brother do that.
Right, exactly.
So I think so. In that sense, I get what you're saying. What sophisticated pro-life people have said to me when I give them that hypo is something along the lines of, well, that's what they say is I would make them do it. In other words, if I'm in a state where that happens, I would make the twin brother. But that's a consistent position for the pro-life person, right?
That is a consistent position. It's, I would say, a bad position, but it is consistent.
Well, it's against, well, it's a bad position because the Supreme Court has said you can't make a you can't, in no state in the country, I think, is it constitutional to force somebody to have an operation against their will to save somebody else.
And
Except,
even
except.
and I even yeah ex except for
Yes.
abortion. And another thing that always strikes me with the sort of organ donation example is that this is even true of cadavers. Like people who are literally dead, like corpses have more rights over their bodies than women. That's absurd.
Yeah, we
Because
agree.
even
We
like
agree.
the deceased or their surrogate would have had to check off on whether they can donate the organ or tissue or what have you. And so it's like, but that suddenly those rights suddenly no longer are available if you can be pregnant.
Yeah, no, I
That's
agree. I think that's a little bit crazy.
yeah.
My final arrow in my bow to liberals and progressives who are pro-choice like me, but also pro-Roe and Casey, which I'm not, is this. If you give judges the power to do this in the face of this amount of opposition, then you're going to give judges to do other things in the face of that amount of opposition. And now we're back to your excellent point earlier, which was, and I've never thought of it this way, so you've really educated me on this. Thank you. I've never said this out loud. I know I've been writing about deference for 25 years, Right. When the court gets too far apart from the American people in any direction, left, right, whatever, in any direction, we have problems. That's when the problems start. I put abortion in that category. In other words, I put abortion in the category of this is an issue that judges just shouldn't deal with absent a clear constitutional provision, which I would vote for in a second. You think I'm crazy about that? I mean, I do think Roe did lead, and Casey, to terrible political results outside of courts.
I think about how slavery was constitutional until the 13th Amendment, until we got that exceedingly clear statement, right?
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that it wasn't awful and at odds with everything that the Constitution is supposed to stand for and that the government claims. And it doesn't mean that people weren't still suffering in that time. And so I think that even if we were to say, oh, you know, we can vote on abortion, I think it's like we can vote on women being people. Like it still leaves people suffering if they're unable to get an abortion, and it's still a violation of their human rights if they're forced to carry a pregnancy to term. So I think that's why I'm sort of like, however abortion is legal, good. But also, when we're thinking about the power that judges have, I am in like full support of court curbing measures more generally. So I think that that might also resolve some of the issues if it's like, okay, judges can do this, but you said for unreviewable judges to have that power. So then it's like, okay, well, what if there was review? What if judicial review was like not the final stop? Or like, what if judicial review was cabined to certain kinds of cases or certain scenarios in a way that it's not now? So I think that my idea of how the Constitution should be interpreted works alongside with other structural reforms, because you can take away courts' powers and still say, well, with the powers they do have, how should they be responsible stewards of that power? So I think they are still in alignment in that way. It's not just sort of like a free-for-all for judges, because I also want to empower the public in a way that the public is not currently empowered.
That's such a great answer. Thank you. And by the way, Jack Balkin is my next guest. So the king of social movement jurisprudence. And yeah. he was my very first podcast guest, and he's going to be my next one too. 120 years. His new book is terrific. I know you. His new book is really good. All right, I have one last kind of observation / question, and then mm-hmm. I could talk to you all day, but we have to go. When I first saw your book, I forget how I came. I guess on Twitter it came to my attention. I think when I first saw it, my this is really true. My first, I'm just being completely transparent here because I'm a legal realist and I preach transparency. So my first emotion was jealousy. Really, it was. Erin Chemerinsky, a good friend of mine, wrote a book called Worse Than Nothing, right? Originally. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book called Originalism is Faith. There have been mm-hmm. a ton of other originalism books. You got it right. You hit it exactly. You're a good wordsmith and a great wordsmith. The originalism trap. I think that word trap is so important because it is, that's what it is. Like you really described exactly what it is. How did it come to you? I'm just curious because
I think it came to me in sort of a similar way to the term inclusive constitutionalism came to me. I think as I was thinking this through, I had been writing at first, and I found myself saying a democratizing method of interpreting the Constitution, or like a model of constitutional interpretation that does X, Y, and Z. And I thought, this is an unnecessary mouthful. What am I really trying to say? Like, what do I think sort of gets to the core of this? So I try to think about what is like the clearest, most succinct, like what is the heart of the matter? And that was how I came to the Constitution includes everyone and should work to make inclusive democracy real. So I thought, boom, inclusive constitutionalism. And I think in a similar way, I was thinking about the bind that originalism puts people in, about how the the left has been sort of lured as to, oh, this is the legitimate way, this is what you should be doing, but it doesn't produce good results for people who care about democracy, for people who care about progressive policy goals. And so I was thinking, it's a trap.
That's great. That's just wonderful. I think the image it conveys is exactly the right image. I do. I really was jealous. I mean, I was like, God, I wish I had thought about that. Congratulations on writing a really, really good book. I want to be clear to everybody. Often I have people on this podcast who write books for lawyers and law professors, because there's a place for that. And I've had a number of guests who've done that. This is not that book. This, I mean, absolutely it's for lawyers and law professors, but this is a much more inclusive book than that. And if you are engaged in current events in any way, any meaningful way, you will enjoy this book, even if you disagree with the book, even if you think originalism is a good thing. That's even a bigger reason to read this book and test your ideas against the critiques in this book, because they are very smart, they are very clear, and they are accessible to the most sophisticated law professor there is and to a fairly well-read common non-lawyer who just, you know, wants to pick up a good, interesting book. So congratulations. Thank you for coming on. I look forward to your voice in the future very much.
Thank you so much, Eric.
It's been really fun. Thanks.